The relationship between population and environmental sustainability is complex, and understanding the fraught history of debates on the issue, in addition to the most current research, is critical for scientists and advocates to have fruitful policy conversations. I'm Andrew Pratt, the Managing Editor for Science Progress, and I'm joined by three experts today to have a conversation about social justice and environmental sustainability. Joining me are Laurie Mazur, who is the Director of the Population Justice Project. She is also the editor of the new book, A Pivotal Moment, Population Justice and the Environmental Challenge. As well, we have Shira Saperstein, who is the Deputy Director and Program Director for Women's Rights and Reproductive Health at the Mariah Fund. She is also a Senior Fellow here at the Center for American Progress. And Brian O'Neill, who is a scientist with the Institute for the Study of Society and Environment at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Laurie, Shira, and Brian, thank you all for joining me today on the Science Progress podcast.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
One of the things that you explain in this new book is that the single largest generation of humans on the planet is about to come of age. And this is sort of a bewildering statistic, that there are 3 billion people under the age of 25. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Can you talk a little bit about global population, how it got there, and where it's headed?
Well, that really depends on the 3 billion young men and women of the largest generation in history. Their choices and the choices that are available to them, importantly, will literally shape the future. Their choices about childbearing will determine whether world population grows from the current 6.8 billion to as many as 8 or even 11 billion by the middle of the century. But unfortunately, too many of those young people have no choices at all. There are some 200 million women who lack access to family planning and reproductive health services. Too many girls are not in school. Too many young women lack opportunities other than early childbearing. Too many families need to have many children in order to ensure that some survive or as to provide economic security in old age.
Now, one of the things that this book focuses on is the interplay, which is more complex than I think people may immediately think, between population and social justice and environmental health and sustainability issues. And one of the things that you end up, some of the chapters in the book talk about, is the relationship between the rate of population increase and how that matters when we're talking about climate change, and particularly when we're talking about potential tipping points as the climate changes in various environments around the world. Can I maybe direct a question at you, Brian, about how you would characterize this relationship and what population, how it connects to these various tipping points?
Well, population is one factor in driving greenhouse gas emissions that result from energy use or from land use.
Mm-hmm.
And those emissions are the ones responsible for causing climate change, and the more climate change we experience, and in some cases the faster we experience it, the more the risk rises that particularly fast, rapid, and potentially very hard to handle impacts may occur. And some of these have been called tipping points because they have the kind of property that once you reach a certain level or rate of climate change that kind of triggers them to start, there's nothing you can do after that to stop them. So you can't back off later and say, whoops, stuff is getting really bad, we'll just back off, cut emissions, and the problem, this impact will go away.
What's a potential example of those kinds of tipping points that we may have already observed?
You know, whether we've observed them or not, or gotten to that point or not, in some cases is not really clear. Some of the tipping points are things that, they're not things like you go to bed one night and you wake up tomorrow and the world is different. They're more like you've put enough greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today that the warming that will happen over the next few decades that we're committed to as a result of the stuff we've already put in the air today is going to lead to an impact that we're not going to be able to escape from. So an example of something that we may have crossed the tipping point for already is disintegration of very large ice sheets, mm-hmm. which would lead to rapid and substantial sea level rise over the coming decades and centuries. And those ice sheets are in Greenland, Antarctica. It may be that, you know, relatively low levels of climate change or rates of climate change could lock us into lock in the disintegration of those ice sheets over the coming centuries, really, and that's going to contribute to sea level rise in a way that we may not be able to escape from. Now, it's not really clear whether we've crossed that, but it's an example of one where it's not like tomorrow we're going to wake up and suddenly Miami is going to be underwater. It's that we will have locked in the slow-moving but powerful climate forces that we can't reverse. And so the scale, what this means on the population side and also on the technology and economic growth side and all of the things that contribute to emissions is that to the extent that we can keep the scale of emissions, the size, the quantity of emissions that we're putting in the atmosphere under control, the better able we'll be able to lower the risks of actually crossing these tipping points, which is particularly important because we're not really sure where those points are.
Now, I want to come back to this relationship between emissions and population growth, but I want to take a step back and maybe frame this issue a little bit, because over the past several decades, starting in the 60s and 70s, these particular kinds of conversations about the relationship between how many people are on the planet and how the environment fares have been contentious, and they have actually, they've gone down sort of dangerous paths about state control of who can have children and how much. And I want to sort of back up a moment and talk about this is not the kind of old-style recommendations or old-style thinking about the relationship between these issues. This is something new. So could you maybe share, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between population and social justice that you all emphasize?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, this issue, population and environment, has been debated for many, many years. And unfortunately, it's often been debated in a very simplistic way. That is, if you go back to Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, it was simply, you know, more people equals more damage. The answer to that is fewer people. And we would never, ever say that that is the case. I think when you talk about population, you're talking about a lot of different things. You're not just talking about population growth. You're talking about age distribution. You're talking about whether people live in rural areas or urban areas. You're talking about whether the population is older, in which case there are lower emissions, for example, with regard to climate change. So there's a whole bunch of patterns and issues beyond fertility and migration that affect population growth, and they all have complicated and complex relationships to environment. Likewise, when you talk about environment, I think you're talking about a range of things. You're not just talking about climate change and global warming. You're also talking about degrading water systems, deforestation, desalinization, etc. And so there is a relationship, but it's far more complex than people have acknowledged in the past. I think partly because we looked at these issues simplistically in the past, we made a lot of mistakes. In the 60s and 70s, the U.S. was the major contributor to international population assistance, and I would say that some good things came out of that. Anytime I think that you give women access to family planning and enable them to plan the size of their families to protect themselves from births that are too early, too late, or too often, that's a good thing. On the other hand, the way that we did those programs in the past were too often focused on demographic targets, on limiting births, on controlling population rather than empowering women to make their own autonomous choices. And as a result, there are some just horrific examples of abuse. When we can talk about the sterilization campaigns of India. We can even talk about the forced abortions in China, which continue to this day. And I think it's very important that scientists and policymakers understand the history and acknowledge the complexity of addressing issues of human and sexual behavior, and therefore develop programs that empower individual choice and respect human rights rather than seek to control individual behavior.
I think the point that you're making about the word targets, population targets, and that being a particularly insidious idea is useful. And another point that this book makes is that you don't actually need to control anyone's choices in a top-down way in order to slow population growth. Can you talk a little bit about this idea of the the already existing unmet need for more reproductive services?
We've learned a lot since the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, both, as Shira said, about we have a more sophisticated understanding of population dynamics. And we've also learned a lot about how to slow population growth and how not to slow population growth. We've learned that the best way to do so is not with top-down population control programs. A generation ago, family planning programs were, as Shira said, designed to meet demographic targets. But then in the 90s, demographers made a game-changing realization that demographic targets were not necessary and in fact, counterproductive if you're hoping to slow population growth. The demographic and health surveys showed that there is, in fact, a huge unmet need for family planning services, that when they asked women in developing countries how many children they want to have, many millions of women said that they wanted to delay or prevent having another child, but were not using contraceptive services. So that is what's characterized as an unmet need for family planning. And filling that unmet need, they found, would reduce fertility as much or more than is called for in the developing countries' demographic targets. So they found that the best way to ensure slower population growth is by making sure that all people have both the means, contraceptive services, family planning and reproductive health services, and the power to make their own decisions about childbearing.
And the power to make those decisions means that contraceptive services alone are nothing. They're necessary but not sufficient. We also need, obviously, programs that ensure that people have a decent standard of living, that people have access to other health services that are integrated with family planning, that girls have access to education and economic opportunities. So it's not simply that family planning can exist in a vacuum. It has to be a part of broader development programs.
So is it fair to say that slowing population growth ultimately isn't really the end here? It's a side effect of empowering people with improved access to health services?
Absolutely. Slowing population growth is a means to many important ends, to improving human well-being, to ensuring environmental sustainability. And it's also worth noting that all of the best means to slow population growth are actually important ends in and of themselves.
Brian, I wonder if we could go back to you and talk about one of the other, you know, potential consequences of slowing population growth, which is the calculations that you've done on how this would affect emissions over the course of the next several decades. Can you talk a little bit about how slowing population growth could account for sort of one of the wedges of the environmental scientists talk about in reducing the overall emissions that we have?
Yeah, I mean some of this work is kind of in progress and unfortunately, I can't talk about the latest and greatest from the work that we've been doing on analyzing this at the global level. But we and other people have looked at in the past in various ways over time, tried to quantify, you know, what are we actually talking about here in terms of magnitude? Does population, you know, have a large impact on emissions outcomes, a small impact? What kinds of other factors matter? Some of the ones that we've talked about already in terms of age structure and urbanization and how these different demographic factors may or may not link to policy. And we have, there's basically two ways of doing this. One is to look at historical data because we do have data on countries and regions around the world over the past several decades. How fast have emissions grown? How fast has population grown? How fast have other things that matter to emissions grown, like size of economies, consumption levels, the kind of technology societies use to produce energy, and so forth. And one can do statistical analyses of these data sets to try to tease out how important actually is population relative to these other things. And you can do the same kind of analysis for using models of how population and economic growth and consumption and technology relate to each other and project them into the future and say, well, if we assume slower versus faster population growth, how much difference does that make? If we assume less versus more economic growth, how much difference does that make? And in general, the conclusion from these kinds of things have been fairly consistent, and that is that population matters. It it is not the largest impact on emissions, but it's not zero either. And while that sounds like a kind of wishy-washy, moderate, middle ground, somewhat boring conclusion, it's actually important because most of the time when these conversations come up about the role of population, the discussion takes place as a kind of polarized debate where one side is saying population is actually the most fundamental and important thing driving not only climate change but environmental impacts of all kinds, and the other side is saying population has nothing to do with this, it's all about consumption. And by and large, kind of no matter how the scientific literature has looked at this, the conclusion has been somewhere in between. Population has a significant effect. It's not zero, but it's also you're not going to solve the climate problem or probably any other environmental problem just by slowing population growth. The analogy to this wedges framework for looking at the challenge of reducing emissions from greenhouse gases is briefly that a framework for thinking about that challenge has been proposed by people at Princeton that they've called this the wedges framework, where they describe an example of reducing emissions between now and the middle of the century sufficiently to put us on an emissions path that would avoid the most dangerous climate change outcomes. And they've estimated that in order to be on that path, we need to reduce emissions between now and 2050 by seven of these so-called wedges. And a wedge is an amount of emissions reduction that starts from zero today, and then you undertake some activity so that reductions increase gradually until by 2050, you're reducing emissions by 1 billion tons of carbon per year. And we need seven of those in order to be on a path to emissions reductions. Now, there haven't been that many, there's really aren't any good analyses of how much slowing population growth could contribute. We're in the middle of doing that right now, but from, you know, kind of circumstantial evidence from the existing analyses at the country level, not the whole world, but chunks of the world, it seems, you know, reasonable to guess that somewhere around one or maybe two of those wedges could come through slowing population growth. And I think that illustrates really what we're talking about. That's pretty significant. If you're looking for seven in total, these things are pretty hard to do, getting a wedge of emissions reductions, and one of them, that's pretty significant. On the other hand, you're clearly not solving the climate change problem through one wedge of emissions reductions associated with population.
Right. This is not something to be considered in isolation.
And That's right.
I think it's useful to say that people who are on either extreme, to say that population is everything when we're talking about sustainability versus population is nothing, it's useful to say, look, there's data saying we need to have this conversation, you know, at neither one of those extremes.
Yeah. And I think I would like to just link back to a way that Chiro was describing the matter, which is considering population as one element of development and of sustainable development. And if there's one thing that is absolutely clear and a kind of basic conclusion from every emission study of future greenhouse gas emissions, it's that if you want to achieve just about any climate change policy goal in the future, one of the most important factors that determine how easy or hard or expensive or cheap is that going to be to do is what you assume about the future development path in different regions of the world. And so all of those elements of development, including population growth, but also the direction that technological change takes, if we're able to improve the productivity of land for agriculture, if energy development takes place in the direction of low carbon energy versus fossil fuel intensive development, the nature of economic growth, how urbanization occurs, whether that's sustainably or resource intensive pathways, these are all linked together, and together they provide the context in which the climate change problem is going to be addressed. And that context is the most important determining factor for how difficult of a job the climate challenge is going to be. And population is just is one part of that.
That feeds into another question that I want to ask. When we first started talking about having this conversation, one of the things that I wanted to point to was the fact that John Holdren, who is the science advisor to President Obama, took a lot of heat over the course of the past couple of months for some work that he did decades ago on these issues about sustainability and population. How can people talk about these issues in a new way, either from a social justice advocate standpoint, and then maybe after we've talked about that, Brian, we can go back to how can scientists talk about these issues in ways that don't invite this sort of totally polarized criticism and argument that's really maybe not even connected to the data.
I would say one thing. I think as we look at the debates going on around climate negotiations in Copenhagen and all around it, we can see how difficult it is to get world agreement on these contentious issues. But if we go back, there actually is a world agreement on how to address population and development issues. The 1994 conference on International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo produced a plan signed on to by 179 nations that all said that access to family planning and reproductive health services was a central human right, that it needed to be in the context of women's rights and empowerment and overall development. And I think so there actually is a working agreement where people come together. And it's interesting to me that we may argue about the role of population and environmental change, but in general, with the exception of perhaps the far right wing, there is agreement that access to reproductive health services, empowering women and giving them more opportunities, and increased global development and an end to world poverty are all good things in and of themselves and things that we want to do.
And so much of the resistance to talking about population issues comes from a fear of where it's headed. So many people are legitimately concerned that concern about the global environment will take us back to the bad old days of population control. So I think it's very important for scientists and others who are working on these issues to be aware of what has happened, to learn about the history, to understand the sensitivities, and to talk about population issues and addressing population issues within the context of the global agreement that we have on these issues that came out of the Cairo Population Conference.
That's interesting because it seems like it's a sort of refreshing way to break with some older liberal conceptions of people in the environment, which are kind of more conservative, that people need to not interact with the environment, that the world would be better if you sort of had fewer people and got them out of the way. So it's actually a more progressive way of talking about progressive issues. Brian, I wonder if you have changed the way or if you've noticed a change in the conversation amongst people coming at this from a more technical direction.
I think so. I mean, there has been more attention in scientific circles to the relationship between population and environment recently, the last several years. And not a lot. It's not been a gigantic change, but there has been some. And I think that that's good because in the absence of that kind of work, people aren't that well informed about it, even within the scientific community, and so they don't have any context to place, to put their own thoughts and opinions on these things in. I think for some of the things that have just been mentioned in how to talk about this issue are important for the scientific community as well. Understanding the history of this issue and understanding the legitimate concerns that people have about talking, raising the issue of population-related policies as a means to, environmental or even other development ends, that those are legitimate, and to understand where those come from. To know something about the fact that the Cairo Agreement exists and this kind of conversation has taken place, and that there is some agreement on how to think about and approach these issues from the policy side. I think that a lot of times scientists get in trouble on this issue, and these are scientists who don't work on population environment issues, because for some reason they feel free to talk about it as if they know what they're talking about when they actually don't. And
I've never encountered that.
I mean, I'm not sure. I find that this is particularly true in certain issues, and population is one of them. And maybe it's because it's something that, you know, people experience in their everyday life, and therefore they kind of feel like, hey, you know, they know why people choose to have children or not to have children, and they know something about migration and so on. So they kind of feel free to assume they know more than they do. So, and this is a kind of a funny thing, because in the climate change issue, for example, you know, someone who studies sea level rise would be pretty careful about talking about ecosystem change, because they know they're not an ecologist and maybe they don't exactly know what they're talking about. But all of a sudden it's a population issue, and they feel free to say anything that comes into their head. And just knowing that, look, there is some work out there, and we have learned that the population influence on the environment is not just about numbers, and also it is clearly not a silver bullet. And so to be able to talk about this in an informed way is important. So the more work that actually takes place within the scientific community, I think the more that will happen. The one thing I would add to that is that I think over time as well, there has been some resistance to, you know, from a certain kind of segment of the community, both inside and outside the scientific community, that it's not okay to talk about demographic consequences at all, that's just off limits, and that we shouldn't even be thinking about, you know, does population matter to emissions and climate change, an assumption that that's off limits, that's not something that we should talk about, and certainly the answer must be no, it doesn't matter. And I think that, you know, we're slowly, you know, over the last few years, I think we're moving to a point where we can talk about that. We can, you know, without everybody getting bent out of shape, we can recognize, hey, look, people have looked at this, you know, now 5, 6, 7, 8 different ways. Population demographic change does have consequences for emissions, and it's okay to raise that. It does not mean necessarily that it follows that demographically related policies are the best way to respond to climate change, but we should be able to have the conversation that's informed from both sides.
That seems like a very useful point, and I want to use that to jump back to a question of, we've been talking about the Cairo Agreement and the fact that there is a framework for instituting these social justice reforms that would provide people with better access to health and reproductive services. What are some of the actual mechanisms, in particular, that the United States can take to enable these things?
Well, first off, we need to ensure that there's universal access to family planning and reproductive health services. As we said before, there's some 200 million women who want access to family planning and don't have it. So that's the bedrock. We need to improve the quality of care. We need to increase the range of services, but we need to make sure that all people have the means to make their own decisions about fertility. And we also need to make sure that people have the power to make those decisions. And that is really about getting at some deep inequities in society, gender inequities and economic inequities. And that means addressing gender inequality by, for example, educating girls and empowering women. It means getting at economic inequities by meeting our commitments under the Millennium Development Goals to ending extreme poverty.
And I would add that the U.S. has been the largest donor to international population assistance for years, and yet there's still inadequate resources for issues that address women's rights and health and the family planning and reproductive health services being one piece of it. But just as with climate change, I think there's a fear of relying too much on an easy technology bullet, as we've seen with kind of the debate over Freakonomics, et cetera. I think we can see that on the population side as well. You know, throwing condoms out of airplanes is not going to make a difference. We're talking about really deep personal decisions about the size of your family and what you need and want in your life. And that's going to require a range of programs. The U.S. has done, quite a lot of work, but has done a very poor job, for example, of integrating reproductive health services across its other programs. For example, there's growing interest right now in the terrible problem of maternal mortality. 500,000 women per year die in or related to childbirth. And yet most of the solutions, policy solutions and otherwise being proposed, fail to address the fact that many of those tragedies could be averted if women had access to family planning services, that much of maternal mortality has to do with women giving birth when they're too young or too old or the births are too close together. There are other things at stake as well. But again, it seems like in many cases that the family planning piece is considered so toxic and controversial, either on the right because of right-wing abortion politics or on the left because we want to make sure that we keep a focus appropriately on consumption rather than on blaming the poor, that we avoid the topic altogether. And just as I think Brian made the case for scientists being more knowledgeable about these issues so that they can weigh in appropriately, I would say the same thing about social justice and women's rights advocates. We need their voices at the table. We need them to engage on these issues. But they have to do so in a way that acknowledges what the science is currently saying and what we know about demographic change.
I want to thank you all for joining me today for this really important discussion about how social justice can actually be an important component of sustainability. Laurie Mazur is the director of the Population Justice Project. Shira Saperstein is the deputy director and program director of the Women's Rights and Reproductive Health Program at the Mariah Fund, and she's also a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. Brian O'Neill is a scientist at the Institute for the Study of Society and Environment at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Thank you, Brian, for joining us from Colorado.
Thank you.
Shira, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Laurie, as well.
Thank you, Andrew.